You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 26, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor William Lozonik, professor of economy at UMass University, on Profits Without Prosperity. Also on the program today, NSA has its own Google to search stuff they shouldn't have. We are 15 days from the New York State primary, where you can vote against Cuomo the Lesser, Zephyr Teachout, and Tim Wu. Now are raising the specter of Kathy Hochul. Also on the program today, Burger King to Canada to buy Tim Hortons donuts and coffee. Meanwhile, ceasefire between Israel and Hamas announced, and the potential of more U.S. airstrikes on ISIS hangs in the air. Bob McDonald, in his corruption trial, announces he has left his home to live with a priest who apparently got caught, in a bawdy place with a man. Virginia, man. And Worcester, number one. Boston, number two. When it comes to the worst drivers in the country, I take special pride in that one today, ladies and gentlemen. Scott Walker, new documents show that, well, just coincidentally, he provided a massive tax break for a company that turned around and gave him massive donations. And, of course, a huge percentage of Americans are afraid that they will catch Ebola, because that's just the place we live in, folks. All that and more on today's program. I first interviewed Bill Lozonik back in April of 2012, and we've been talking for some time about the changes that took place in the early 80s that have led to such incredible wage stagnation. And one of the factors is something that Bill Lozonik has been writing about for some time, and it deals with the way that executives are given their compensation, where they begin to use their own corporations as essentially a financial instrument in their own little cottage industry of making money through stocks. We're going to take a break and we will talk to him in just a second. Just a reminder, this show relies on you to for 99% of its revenue. Become a member today at majority.fm. All right, we'll be right back with Bill Lozonik. this.
My camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way I'm slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah. And you wasn't alone.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Professor William Lozonik, economist from UMass and the co-director of the Center for Industrial Competitiveness, on his piece in Harvard Business Review, Profits Without Prosperity. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And this follows up in many respects on your book, Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy. Let's talk about sort of the premise or the situation that we find ourselves in this context of our economy now.
Okay. I think the problems are generally recognized, that there's been a huge concentration of income at the top. Now, of course, Thomas Piketty has his unexpectedly best-selling book out there, Capital in the 21st Century, but the most valuable part of that book are the data that he's been collecting for some time on the top 1%, the top one-tenth of 1%, and I have actually been using those data for, well, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, and they're very valuable. They show us that what's happened over a century to the income distribution, and year by year we just see this concentration of income at the top. But the other thing that we see is that people can't find good, stable employment. And it's not just people who only have high school educations. It's people with college education, people who should be able to find jobs fairly easily in the economy. And the book you mentioned, Sustainable Prosperity in the New Economy, and a question mark after that, Business Organization High-Tech Employment in the United States, just came out in 2008. I started really writing that around 2005, and I could see I've been tracking both this concentration of income at the top, the loss of middle-class jobs for some time from the 90s on various research projects I was involved in, and I could see what was happening. Of course, when I started writing that around 2004, 2005, things didn't look so bad. The economy was kind of booming, but the jobs still weren't there in the way they had been before, certainly in the way they had been in the 1980s and even in the 1990s, in the late 1990s and the Internet boom. So I decided to focus in that book on the information communication technology industries, the industries which really came out of the microelectronics revolution, the Internet revolution, and say, here are college-educated people in a booming industry. They should be the best situated to find jobs, and found that, in fact, they weren't very well situated, and the situation was coming worse. And it was for two reasons in terms of the way employment relations had changed. The first was that up through the 1980s, basically, if you got a job with Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Motorola, Texas Instruments, a whole number of other companies in the economy, and generally with any major Fortune 500 company, and particularly if you had a college education, you basically had a career, the expectation at least of a career for life with that company, and you could build on that over time. Your pay would go up over time. You had a defined benefit pension at the end, and all that started to change. Actually, changed quite dramatically in the 1990s. But for those people, it was kind of masked by the fact that there were all these startups, there's all these other opportunities in the economy, and that started to really change with the internet boom and bust. As occurred in 2001-2002, they started talking in 2002-2003 about a jobless recovery. And one of the things we saw is that, in fact, there were a lot of highly qualified people in places like China and India, often employed by the same companies, who could do those jobs and generally do them for less pay. But the important thing is that they were highly qualified by this time. So people who would supposed to be best situated in the economy to get good jobs all of a sudden found that, well, they weren't so well situated, particularly if they were in their 40s and 50s and the companies laid them off, as increasingly they did. So that was basically what the first part of the argument that I made about the change in employment relations that had occurred in this transition to what I call the new economy business model. But the second part of it, which is what this Harvard Business Review article focuses about on, and what something I've been looking at really since the 1980s, the late 1980s, when the phenomenon started, was companies were not only declining to give secure employment to workers with a lot of skill, a lot of education, but they were taking the profits that they were making and just distributing to shareholders, who basically, and I can go into this, have nothing to do with the company other than buying and selling shares, and not just paying them dividends, which is the traditional way in which you pay people a return who are holding shares, or give them a return on the investment they made in the stock market by holding the shares, but something which really came in on a large scale in the 1980s, which was stock buybacks, repurchasing stock. And unlike dividends, which give a yield for people who hold shares, buybacks reward people who sell shares, who get out of the company. And I've been watching this for some time, and over the last decade, or really after 2001, they became massive. They were already pretty large in the 90s and 1997 for the whole corporate economy. Buybacks as a form of distribution to shareholders surpassed dividends. But they came massive in after 2000. And between 2003 and 2007, I was tracking it year by year. You saw that for the S&P 500 companies, or really similar to the Fortune 500 companies, largest 500 companies in the United States, generally, they were going from about $300 million per year on average to $1.2 billion. So by 2007, just before the financial crisis, $600 billion in money was flowing out of those companies just to try to give their stock a manipulative boost. And that declined a bit in 2008, 2009, but now it's back again. And so what we have now is a huge amount. Companies have record profits, these companies. They are, however, not using it to invest in innovation, particularly innovation that can have an impact over the long run. They are not using it to keep their employees employed. In fact, just the opposite. You'll find a company like IBM will be laying off employees so it can do more buybacks, get its stock price up, get its earnings per share up. In fact, in the case of IBM, they set that as a goal of what their company is all about. And basically, I can go into much more detail how this occurs, but it's destroying the U.S. economy. I mean, it's not just bad for the people who don't have jobs. It's basically turning the U.S. into a second-rate economy.
So essentially what we have is a story of value extraction from these companies versus a value creation. And part of this is essentially tied into the the incentive structure for the leadership of these companies. Let's start there, and then you can walk us through what these stock buybacks what they mean and how they take place.
Yeah. Okay. So. So the question is, if these are so bad, not just for the economy as a whole, but for the companies themselves. I mean, this boost that they give to when you go and you buy back your stock, it's a temporary boost by the laws of supply and demand when they do what are called open market repurchases, which are the type I'm mainly talking about. People who control that money inside the companies, the top executives, are just throwing this out kind of into the ether, giving it away. And then you say, well, why are they doing this? And in the Harvard Business Review article, I go through the various reasons that they give. One is well, our stock is undervalued and we're making an investment.
Well, let's, before we go through these reasons, yeah, let's, I mean, okay, walk us through.
Okay. Well, if you want to get to the bottom line of this, why are they doing it?
Well,
I
no,
go through the
let,
reason.
Let's yeah. start. Let's start with. I mean, just explain for people what a stock buyback is.
Okay. So
I mean,
basically,
just...
yeah. So basically, okay. A company has some, you know, generates cash. Can even borrow to do them, but assume it generates cash, and then there's a question of what is it going to do with it, with that cash. You might call it with its profits. And, you know, in fact, when companies grow and they're healthy and the economy is healthy, what they do is they keep their experienced workers employed. They pay them higher wages because, in fact, they contributed in the past to generating those profits. They invest in new technologies. And also, they pay taxes to the government, which actually invests in technologies, too, which are useful to these companies and also in infrastructure, et cetera. So a whole lot of things depend on what's done with profits. Companies in the always have paid out dividends to shareholders. Shareholders basically are just people, you know, I mean, who, like we're me, or buy or sell shares. And we have nothing to do with the company. We don't really even invest in the company. We just buy other people's shares. Okay, that's a traditional way in which people who hold shares on the public stock markets get a return on that portfolio investment. But what the stock buyback is an additional way of doing this. And as I said before, it's a way of not giving people a return for holding shares, but actually giving the price a boost so that they can sell their shares at a higher price, get out of the company. Okay, so the way this is done is, you know, you've got the stock market there, a company goes in and they do what's called open market repurchases. So they tell their broker, we want to today buy back $200 million worth of stock, or we want to do it for the next week. And that is going to give their stock price a boost. Presumably people start noticing that their stock price is going up, and it might give it some more momentum. Now, in general, the only people who are or know about this are that went the days they're actually doing it are the top executives who order them to do it, and I guess their broker. And that's a problem in and of itself because there's some inside information there that potentially some people in the know can trade on, but none of us know whether they do or not because we, even after the fact, they now tell us how much buybacks they did every quarter, but really the issue is what precise days did they do them. Now, that amount can be very large, and it's actually, and I say this in quotes, it's regulated. And so let me talk a bit about why they're allowed to do this. In many countries, until the late 90s in Europe, buybacks were illegal. They still are in many places because they were seen as being a potentially a way of manipulating the stock market. Now, we do have a regulatory agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, set up in 1934 to eliminate manipulation and fraud in the stock market. And for a long time, many decades, that's what the Securities and Exchange Commission tried to do. And one of the things that concerned a lot of the regulators in the Securities and Exchange Commission in the 50s, 60s, and throughout the 70s was this potential for a company to manipulate its stock price through large-scale stock buybacks. So they tried to push through some regulation on this to limit the amount that could be done, to disclose when you were doing it. And if, in fact, you went over a certain amount, you could be charged, or the executives who order these buybacks could be charged with manipulating the market. Okay, and there was a regulation that was proposed. It was never passed, but that was what the regulators would try to do. Now, that changed very quickly in the winter of 1981. And probably the most important thing that happened in the winter of 1981 is Ronald Reagan became the president of the United States. on a platform of deregulating the stock markets. And one of the first things he did was he appointed a new head for the Security and Exchange Commission, a guy named John Shadd. Now, John Shadd had been a executive of E.F. Hutton, a Wall Street brokerage firm, a retail brokerage firm, and he was a believer in Chicago-type economics, that you got to make markets efficient, that if you regulate markets, there'll be less trading on markets, they'll be less efficient, and if they're less efficient, there'll be less capital available to companies, so let's make those markets more efficient, get the regulators out of there. He also happens to have been, the reason he got appointed, probably, is that he was the first Wall Street executive to come out to support Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign of in 1980, and he was, in fact, the head of the campaign for New York State. So this was kind of his reward. Very quickly, the rules were changed, and this is a rule called Rule 10b-18, which was passed really under the radar in November of 1982, which basically said that a company had a safe harbor against being charged with manipulating the market if its stock buybacks were 25% or less of its average trading volume over the previous 4 weeks. Now, that translates into, let's say, for a company like Microsoft, $200 million a day, $250 million a day. ExxonMobil, one of the big repurchasers, $250 million, $300 million a day. Actually, for Apple, it translates into about $1.5 billion per day. And that can be done day after day after day without having any fear that you'll be charged with manipulating the market. So important point here is that it's actually on the, you know, it's there's a notion within the SEC that this could be manipulating the market. Now, whether that large amount is manipulating the market, you know, you have to, well, I think it is. Now, the other thing about this rule, which was different than what had gone before when they actually tried to regulate the market, there was no presumption that if you went over the 25% that this would necessarily be manipulation. And the third point, which is really an important point, is the SEC does not require any disclosure about when you actually do these buybacks. So the SEC doesn't actually know if they're going over this 25% limit, which is in any case quite high.
And it seems to me they also they can't measure as to whether or not it's actually what impact it's having on the stock price.
No,
right?
So we don't know. And now here's the other part of it, is that executives, why do they do it? Okay, and I can come back to it if you want, and about the reasons that they give, which don't hold water, and this is what I do in one part of that Harvard Business Review article. The reason they do it is quite simple. They get paid to do that. So if you take for 2012, which is the latest full data set that I have, and you take the 500 highest paid executives that are reported on proxy statements, and this is in Standard & Poor's puts out its executive comp database. This is what I use. And not all of them are CEOs, but let's say about half of those 500 are CEOs of the companies. But if you take their average total compensation from all the different components of compensation, it was about just a little over $30 million on average, $30 million on average for those executives.
$30 million per year.
Yeah, for that 1 year. It varies, and it varies a lot according to the state of the stock market. Okay. 82% of that $30 million was stock-based pay. About 40% was gains from exercising stock options, and about 42% were the gains realized on the vesting of stock awards. Stock awards have become more and more popular, and usually they have tied to them some. They get triggered when you have an earnings per share target that you hit. So they're tied to the short term performance of your stock. The same with with stock options, although stock options, you'll give them to an executive and they'll be, have, let's say, they have to wait at least a year to exercise them, 1 to 4 years, but then they have up to 10 years in a window in which they, a long window, big door, in which they can exercise them. But they're going to gain depending on the timing of those exercises. And we don't know this, but it must be going on. And executives who know when those buybacks are being done could be trading on inside information. Now,
and so,
on the face of it, that would be illegal, but actually, it's not only don't know, the SEC has never even looked into the matter. So it's just something that is totally, in a sense, unregulated. Not only unregulated, but since 1982, basically encouraged companies to do this. And more executives then were given incentives, gave themselves incentives through kind of their boards and sitting on each other's boards and a whole kind of inside job of the way they get their pay up, which I could go into, to incentivize themselves to get rich. Well, in fact, they're destroying their companies.
Let me recap here, because basically what you're describing is, you know, what you see in the movies about those penny stocks with a pump and dump scheme.
Yeah,
they pump up the price of the stock by using the company's profits to buy the stock back. It pushes the prices up. The dump only happens for a small group of people, those being the executives themselves, who receive their compensation in the form of options and vested stock. And I guess
if they own the stock, they might do it that way. You know, if they have it. But the point is that these are not penny stocks,
right? And
yeah,
and
these are 500. You know, the data set I use is 70% of the market capitalization, 70-75% of the market capitalization of all corporations in the United States. 500. Let me give you some other statistics, how important large corporations are to the U.S. economy and therefore what they do. Okay, there's about, the last data were collected by the census in 2007. There were just under 2,000 companies in the United States that had 5,000 or more employees. Okay, those 2,000 companies, they were, I think, a tiny, tiny fraction of all the companies. Obviously, there's millions of companies out there that are registered. But those companies had about 33% of the employment in the business sector of the United States, and that's about 83% of total employment, with the government being another 17%. So they had a huge proportion of employment, about 37% of the payrolls, and about 43% of the revenues. Now, what those companies do or don't do also affects small businesses and people who are consulting for those companies, restaurants, hotels, where they operate. If those companies don't invest, don't employ people, don't pay people higher wages who have worked hard for them and helped generate the profits, don't support the economy, the local, state, and national level that have supplied them with infrastructure, with educational services, all kinds of things without which they could operate, our economy would not have ever become the world's leading economy and can't remain a prosperous economy. It comes down to that. And that's why this issue of what these big companies are doing is so important, because, in fact, so if we take the last decade, 2000, this actually updates data that's in the Harvard Business Review article, 2004 to 2013, a decade, you take those 500 companies, and there's about 450 of them that were listed for that whole period, 54% of their net income went to buybacks, another 34% to dividends. So there's very little left over once they've done that can go to higher wages for their employees, to job security, to additional new investment that other than what they've done, let's say their R&D investment, which is already before profits, but adding to that to respond to new competition. When you add into that the well-known fact that a big portion of the profits of these companies are held abroad, and in fact we have crazy tax laws that encourage them to do that, that actually go back to 1960, we then start to understand why, what I call profits without prosperity, why we have companies that have now record profits in the last few years, and people just are looking out there and saying, hey, where's the prosperity? Where's the jobs? Where's the employment security? Where's the higher wages? I would say it's because of this.
So, before this practice sort of start to gain momentum, and part of the things that I know that we've talked about in the past was that the part of the incentive in the first place to give executives stock options and stocks as a form of compensation was a function of the changes in the tax code, whereby they would get lower taxes because as stocks, they would be paying capital gains taxes on this stuff as opposed to wage taxes. That before this
happened. Okay, that I think is one of the things we talked about a few years ago when we had the discussion. But let me just summarize that, because it's what basically happened in terms of executive pay, and this is an interesting contrast, is you have to go back to 1950, and tax rates, we had a very progressive personal income tax structure. the highest marginal tax rate was 91% on incomes at that time of over about $200,000. And executives lobbied after World War II to try to get their a part of their income taxed at a lower rate, and they hit upon stock options, which they actually had to hold the stock for about a year after they exercised them, but they could then claim the gains at the gains tax rate, which was 25%. So that came into effect in 1950. By a decade later, this started to be noticed by people, including there was an article in Harvard Business Review by the dean of Harvard Law School in 1960, which said, have stock options gotten out of hand? And it said, hey, this is compensation income. Why are they getting capital gains, a treatment on this? They're not putting any money in there. They're not risking any money. This is part of compensation income. And Albert Gore, the father of Al Gore, who was a senator from Tennessee, then took this up as a big issue. And over the course of the 1960s and right up to 1976, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, they got rid of that tax privilege for executives. So surprisingly enough, you had a time in this country where they didn't just do whatever executives wanted them to do. And so at that time, compensation consultants were saying, stock options are dead. Okay, what came back from the 1980s had nothing to do with capital gains tax versus personal income tax. All the tax rates were lowered. Of course, that was part of the Reagan Revolution and part of the ideology that if you want people to invest in the economy, you got to give them lower tax rates. Well, of course, what we see here is just the opposite. Executives are avoiding tax like crazy for themselves, for the corporation, so they have more profits to buy back stock. And this is not leading to investment in the economy, just the opposite. So if we take actually data, there's just a different type of data that's from the Federal Reserve puts out, which is net equity issues minus buybacks, basically, and shares taken off the market from mergers and acquisitions. For the last decade, it's minus $378 billion per year. So basically, corporations fund the stock market. The stock market doesn't fund does not fund corporations. And what happened is that through giving them stock-based pay, executives were given the incentive to do this, to get their stock price up and to make out for themselves. It's stock-based pay, which requires no risk on their part. So here's one example of this. up until May of 1991, if you were a top executive and you exercised your stock options, there were rules that were on the books of the Securities Exchange Commission. Again, the agency is supposed to regulate the stock market. Up to that point, this went back to 1934, that said as kind of an insider, you had to wait 6 months before you sold the stock. Okay, well, executives didn't like this because in the 6 months, you know, they could exercise the options, have the stock, and the price could go down. So they got the rule changed. And May 1990, from then on, as soon as they exercise the option, they can sell the stock and take the gains for themselves. So basically what you have in place is a system where, you know, yeah, it's pump and dump, but it's the top executives of the largest corporations who are doing this and enriching themselves in the process.
Can we measure and can you just sort of give us a sense of just this money that they're basically extracting from the company, right? I mean, and this concept, I think people get, you know, even on my in my little enterprise here on the Majority Report, the bottom line is I need to take a certain amount of money out of the company as my income. I don't have the,
sure,
the stock, yeah, options and whatnot. But if I was to get what I need for my income and then plus I plug it back into the company and I expand the company, I hire another person, I start doing more shows, whatever, I do better video,
yeah, right.
I hire someone to build a backdrop, all this. This is all actually issues that we're dealing with here now. In this instance, we have a situation where I am incentivized not to grow the company, but just to increase its stock value. We don't have stock value here, but I'm pretending for a moment, because that's the way I'm going to really make my money. Do you have a sense of just how much less sort of corporate growth, company growth and company reinvestment has been lost to this extraction?
Okay. Well, yeah.
I mean, it's apples and oranges, obviously, because we don't have the same companies.
Okay. So in the Harvard Business Review article, I have a graph, which is the relation between real productivity growth in the economy and real wage growth. And what it shows is that from about 1946, I think the data go till about 2012 or 2013. They might even go to there, forget how recently, but right up to the present, basically. From 1946 up until the late 1970s, real wages tracked productivity growth. Okay, now, well, how did that happen? Well, I would argue the main reason was that these corporations were very powerful then, as they are now, but they had a different set of employment practices. Once you got, as I said, once you got a job with one of these companies, is the expectation would be that you were there for a career and your pay would go up over time. And that was true not just for white-collar workers, but for blue-collar workers who did this through collective bargaining, by and large. Okay, and so when we see that at the macroeconomic level that we had growing higher standards of living, higher real wage growth over decades until the inflation of the 1970s hit, which changed things a lot, that you had real wage growth and higher standards of living going not just to a few people at the top, but actually around 1970, if you look at the Piketty data, that was the point at which you had the least concentration of the income at the top, and other data show that you had this trend toward more income equality in the post-war two decades. I would argue the main reason for that, absolutely the main reason for that, was these employment practices of large corporations. It was particularly good for white males, because women weren't as represented at that time. Certainly African-Americans weren't as represented at that time among these long-term employees. But you had this trend for more, toward more income inequality. Now, what happens from the late 1970s is you then see a wedge, a gap, between productivity growth and wage growth. Wage growth grows much more slowly, and you can see it visually that there is a growing gap that grows and grows and grows right up to the present between the productivity the economy is generating and the wages that people are getting. Now, that is because the gains that are being made in those companies are not being shared in that way. Companies will lay off people at a drop of a hat. They'll get people to work harder without hiring more people. They will move overseas without worrying about the fact that people who have worked for them for 20 or 30 years all of a sudden are without employment with no chance of getting new employment. Basically, it's a whole different ethos of which set in the 1980s about for whom companies are run and who should gain, and it all became focused around stock price.
Now, Bill, let me ask you this too. Now, and I'm looking at this graph, and it's clear that it's had an impact on wage growth, right?
Yeah.
Because essentially, this money is going into the hands of executives rather than being put back into the company in the form of paying employees incremental.
Let me just make one point about that. It's not just that it's going in the hands of executives. So I gave that figure of $30 million on average for the 500 highest paid executives. So this is their employment income. This is not property income. This is employment income. Okay, that's a big number. It's actually about 600 to 900 times the average worker. Okay, it's a huge number. It's a huge number historically. It's a huge number today by international comparison. However, if you distributed that money to workers, there would be some gain, but not a whole lot. That's not where the damage is done. It's the buybacks where the damage is done. So let's just say hypothetically that a company, as is often the case, can do $1 billion in buybacks this year, and that enables their stock price to increase, and through ways that we can't even see, the executives can cash in their options, hit their stock award targets, and make, let's say, an extra $50,000. You say, okay, well, $50,000, that's just a tiny fraction of $30 million. It's not the $50,000 that's the problem, although that's going into their pocket because of this manipulation. It's the $1 billion in buybacks. And it goes beyond just that money, because what it means is that these people who control the resources, really the allocation of resources, not just in these companies, but when you add it all up in the economy as a whole, a huge amount of resources, it's not just that they're failing to share it with their existing employees, but they're not investing in the new technologies, the plant and equipment, the technologies and supporting the government to do this, which it needs, that are going to create prosperity in the future. Going even further than that, I would say, it's hard to prove this, I would say at some point they become incapable of doing that. That anybody who's running a large corporation and routinely is, as let's say Steve Ballmer was when he was the CEO of Microsoft, is willing to just throw $10 billion a year out there to people who do not matter to the company, except maybe that Bill Gates likes it because it increases the value of his foundation. They can't possibly, in my view, at the same time, they have to be schizophrenic to be able to have a vision of the future of a technology company. And I think it shows up in the results.
Let me just recap here too. We're watching the benefits of the company go to the executives at an increasingly higher rate than it does the employees. But it's also that this money is being allocated in such a way because it does help the executives in terms of their pay, but it also hurts the future prospects of the company itself because it's no longer in the business of saying, this is our 20-30-year plan. We're going to invest in new machinery today. We're going to invest in new markets. We're going to invest in new job training. Really, what we're just investing in is increasing the value of the company today, because that is what I am incentivized to do as an executive now. In the future, we can all just sort of wink and nod at each other it doesn't really matter that much.
That's right. Yeah, and not only are they incentivized to do this. So this is the other part of the puzzle here. Is, and I was around when this happened in the 1980s. I was working. I had been from a graduate student in the Harvard Economics Department in the early 70s. I was a faculty member there from 1975 to 1984, and then for a couple of years I was a research fellow at Harvard Business School and maintained close relations with people at Harvard Business School, particularly people doing business history, a well-known business historian named Alfred Chandler, who I was very close to, who were looking at how the U.S. economy had become successful. And at that time, in 1985, actually, the president of Harvard University, the dean of Harvard Business School, went out of their way to hire a guy named Michael Jensen, who was an advocate of maximizing shareholder value, the guru, the academic guru of maximizing shareholder value. And he, more than anybody else, but a whole number of people, and they were all trained at Chicago. He had come through University of Rochester, which was an even more extreme version of free market capitalism than Chicago, to Harvard Business School. And they were arguing that what companies should do is just distribute cash to shareholders. They're the only ones who take risk, and they're going to redistribute it somehow in the economy, and we'll have a more successful economy. They also then made the argument, pay executives and stock-based pay incentivized to do this, but they created a whole economic theory around what's called maximizing shareholder values that said that this would result in a more successful economy. Now, the theory is totally wrong. It's wrong because, first of all, the people who you're giving this money to take very little risk because they can sell their shares whenever they want because we have a liquid stock market. The people who take the risks are the people who come to work, work hard today. Sure, they get paid wages, they get a salary, but you're really working hard today and you're working with other people and you're learning about how to do things and you're learning how to market and you're learning how to purchase, learning how to manufacture, how to do R&D and put them all together. Because you want to create a future for yourself, and that future is very bound up with the company. So 4 or 5 years after that, when what you did 4 or 5 years before or for several years before starts resulting in products, the competitive products that generating profits for the company, and then the executives invoke maximizing shareholder value to say, well, we can just get rid of you, you're being robbed. And also, we as taxpayers are in the same position. Because although there's this ideology that the government doesn't do anything, that it shouldn't be in the economy, there's no technology that exists in the United States that is of any importance, where for decades the government hasn't first, our taxpayer money really, hasn't been first put at risk in developing it. We then pass it on to businesses, and that's what we need to do, let them produce competitive products with it, but then we need to get some of that money back. And, of course, we know that what's happened is executives say that, and venture capitalists and everybody in the financial community says we need a lower tax rate to incentivize ourselves, us to invest, as if they're the only ones that matter. And, in fact, what you're investing in is people. What you're investing in is a government that is going to invest, provide infrastructure, new knowledge, and maximizing shareholder value just takes that all away. So
you give a couple of examples of this in your piece. ExxonMobil gets $600 million a year in U.S. government subsidies for oil exploration, but spends $21 billion a year in buybacks. You talk about in nanotechnology and pharmaceutical drugs in particular, where there's
pharmaceutical drugs is a very good example. So I used a number of examples, and I could give a lot of other examples and company examples. Well, we do a lot of research at the company level to see what damage is done, when it occurs, etc. But here's the pharmaceutical example. So we know that in the United States, when we pay for pharmaceutical drugs, it's twice the price anywhere else in the world. Okay, you can say that your insurance policy may pay for it, but then we have higher premiums as a result. Okay. We know that because actually in the UK they regulate drug prices and they put out a schedule every year, and it shows that the United States is about twice as what they are anywhere else, including the UK. Okay, so then every once in a while, that's been addressed in Congress. The champion in trying to deal with the drug companies was Henry Waxman from California, who I think is just retiring, or is retired.
Yeah.
And he would, and others, a few others would say, why are you charging high drug prices? And they would say, because we do so much R&D in the United States, and this is good for keeps the United States as a leading country for the production of pharmaceutical drugs. And if you want all this R&D done in the United States, then you have to have we have to have the profits to enable us to do this and decrease our R&D expenditures. Okay. All they needed to do was then say, well, what are you actually doing with the money? And they would see that 50% to 100% of their money, quite apart from dividends, is going to buybacks. And so high drug prices actually just allow companies to do more stock repurchases that boost their stock price, that boost their executive pay. So that's basically what we're paying high drug prices for, is to increase executive pay. Now, the other side of this, however, is even worse than that, because now all those pharmaceutical companies don't have anything in the pipeline.
Right.
And we see Pfizer trying to go abroad and merge abroad to avoid taxes. There's been now, over the last few years, last several years, a collapse of their research capabilities. And they're just extracting value from those companies. So they've actually wrecked the pharmaceutical industry in this company. This is happening in biotech, too. Amgen, which is the leading independent biotech company, started doing buybacks in 1992 and has since then spent more than 100% of its profits doing buybacks. It still has some blockbuster drugs. It's still making profits. Eventually, those will run out, and that company will go down the tubes.
I have two more questions because we're starting to run short on time here. Before we get to the proposals to fix it, so do we reach a period, and have we reached that period, or is it depend on the industry where the chickens essentially come home to roost? I mean, in other words, obviously, if a company has been doing R&D and been expanding over the course of the years and then begins to taper that off so that they can fund these buybacks, at one point, they can't go any further. Are we starting to see that in pharmaceuticals? Are we starting to see that in other industries? And is there a – are we a decade out?
Yeah.
I mean
– but okay, particularly companies might go to the wall. Like an example is Hewlett-Packard. Which did tens of billions of buybacks I think it was 2010, 2011, I'm not sure to have the years exactly right, but for a couple of years, and then I think it was 2012, had a $12 billion loss. And that company is going nowhere. Okay. They had actually high-flying stock price in the mid-2000s, even 2006, 2007, even higher than many other companies, because while they were in fact running the company down. Okay, that company is basically going to the wall. The same action actually happened with BlackBerry, and they started doing huge buybacks when somehow they didn't get it, that they had to compete with Apple, or maybe their top executives got it and said, okay, let's give our stock price a boost and get out of here. Okay, at some point you see, the end game appears. But for many of these companies, they have such entrenched market positions, like an Intel, Microsoft, ExxonMobil, Apple now, that they can do this stuff for a long period of time and still generate lots of profits and seem like they are companies that this is not hurting them. But my argument is it does hurt them. Even those companies, they stop being innovative. It hurts the employees who work for them, and it hurts the economy as a whole, and it basically is just wrong. So I argue, first of all, you should just ban open market stock repurchase by large company. The only thing they do is manipulate stock prices. We have rules against manipulating stock prices. And not only do they manipulate stock prices, the people who make the decisions have an incentive to do this. So the second thing you have to do is have incentives for top executives that are dependent on the value create, not on the value they extract. And the value they create is, can be measured in many ways by the types, by the higher incomes that the people who help them create value get, and that is often thousands of employees in those companies. The third thing is, you know, the ways in which companies are governed in this country is totally corrupt. It's all an insider game, and I have written some other things, including a paper for the Roosevelt Institute, which I wrote in June, called Taking Stock, How Executive Pay Leads to Instability and Inequality in the Economy, where basically you have everybody, CEOs sitting on each other's boards, and everybody having a community of interest to just get stock prices up. So even when stock prices come down, the board will say, well, oh, you're not making as much money this year. That's not your fault. The whole stock market is down. So let's give you more stock options. Let's give you more stock awards, and we want you now to get your stock price up. And then they go to do the buybacks. They manipulate the market. They start to get the stock price up. They get higher pay. The economy continues to go down the tubes. Mm. So my other recommendation is that we have to change corporate governance structure. We have to put people who really are the value creators have a representation on the board. And that includes workers as a group, and that includes taxpayers as a group. These public companies, the people who run them are employees. Shareholders really are just portfolio investors, people who get in and out, have nothing to do with the company. If they had to know something about the companies, they probably wouldn't hold shares in it. Or if they know something about the company, like a Carl Icahn, who takes a half of 1% per stake in Apple, gets to invite Tim Cook over to his house for dinner, says, let's do $150 billion stock buyback. I think that in itself should be illegal just to be able to have that access. And then has nothing to do with the company, never contributed to that company at all, is just, you know, that those people have to be reined in. They have to be stopped. And so you have this whole other part of this problem, which people, Wall Street. So what does Wall Street have to do with this? Well, I think one of the things that has allowed Wall Street to become such a gambling casino and to have control of so much of the GDP and the economic activity in the country, and have even pay there that makes $30 million seem like nothing for a hedge fund manager, that it's all this money flowing out of the real economy through buybacks and can't forget dividends because they've gone up too, that is feeding Wall Street. So for those 450 companies I mentioned before for the last decade, it's about $6 trillion combined, about $3.4 trillion in buybacks, about $2.5 in dividends. That's going into the financial economy, and the people who are getting control of that, what are they doing? They're using their financial power to try to get even more money, extract more money from the economy. So we basically have a value-extracting economy that's totally outweighed the value-creating economy, and we have to bring that under control. And until we do, I think we're going to have just more of the same. We're going to have more concentration of income at the top. We're going to have more disappearing middle-class jobs, more income inequality, more basically profits without prosperity. And so, you know, I'd argue that this is the central economic issue with which we have to deal with in this country.
Bill Ozonek, the piece is Profits Without Prosperity. We have a link to it on our site at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff.
Okay, thanks a lot. All right,
folks, we're going to take a quick break. Went a little long today. I just think is fascinating, and I do not hear, I have yet to come across anybody else writing about this or doing research about this, and it is so clear that if this is not the story, it is a big part of the story on the stagnating wages that we have seen in this country. And the graph is in the piece is really pretty clear cut. I mean, you can see where the change in the tracking of productivity and profits for companies takes place right around this time, where these large corporations, which control just a handful, 2,000 of them, control a huge percentage of our work in this country. You can see where it happens. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to head into the funner half. A reminder that it is your memberships which support the free show, and as a bonus, we give you a bonus extra 50 minutes a day. Today it's going to be a little shorter. We went a little bit long in the freebie, but like I say, this stuff is fascinating to me, and I hear about it nowhere else. Nowhere else. Although you'll also hear it on Ring of Fire this weekend, because I'm going to talk to him again for Ring of Fire, but not obviously in the depth that we could provide on this program. So if you have the financial means, particularly if you're one of those executives doing these buybacks, become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support this program if you buy crap from Amazon. Buy it through our Buy Crap from Amazon link at majoritireportkickback.com. All you got to do is click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through that. We get a kickback. Every little bit helps. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. We're going to take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. Of course, you can IM us at Majority FM. You can IM us through the app, which you can get at majorityapp.com. We'll be right back after this.